Hi, everyone. This is Marion from the Talking Information Center, and this is the Salem News for Tuesday, February 17th. In Salem, some 400 years after Roger Conant founded the settlement of Salem, the city is commemorating its legacy with the formal establishment of a sister city relationship with Conant's birthplace of East Budleigh, England. The Salem City Council voted unanimously last Thursday to formalize the sister city relationship between the community of Conant's birth and the community of its founding. The culmination of a years-long dialogue between East Budleigh and Salem, the city will now endeavor to demonstrate the unique relationship in ways such as cultural exchanges, historical research collaboration, educational programs, tourism, and more. Salem resident and small business owner Karen Scalia of Salem Food Tours helped initiate these discussions and move the idea forward over the past year. In June of 2025, Scalia delivered a letter from Mayor Dominic Pangallo to the East Budleigh with Brictor Parish Council with an offer for the two communities to mark their historic connection together. A significantly different community than Salem, East Budleigh is a small village in East Devon, England, of around 850 people. However, Scalia said that her visit to the community last spring revealed that East Budleigh shared modern Salem's reputation of open-mindedness and hospitality. Last spring, she said, I had the pleasure of visiting East Budleigh as I prepared for the 400th anniversary and a plan with my small business, and it was life-changing. Roger Conant is remembered for his attitude of tolerance and reconciliation among the early settlers of New England. I felt that same spirit when I visited there, she said. In the process of writing his book, The Founding of Salem, City of Peace, resident Benjamin Shallop had the opportunity to speak and form a relationship with the people of East Budleigh through video calls, describing it as a wholesome and welcoming experience. Especially during this time when relationships with Europe, the UK, and Canada have become strained, I think it's more important than ever that we reach back to establish friendships at the local level with people, Shallop said. I look forward to continuing to develop a lasting relationship with our friends across the pond. In April of 1592, Roger Conant was born in the village of East Budleigh in England. 34 years later, in 1626, he led a group of English colonists who arrived on the ship Arbella in what would become known as Salem. Conant was selected to be the first governor of the colonists until 1628, laying the groundwork for Salem's future as the center of trade and commerce. Roger Conant is central to Salem's story, and we're proud to celebrate that legacy alongside our friends in East Budleigh, Pangallo said. We're thrilled to commemorate our milestone anniversary by formalizing this relationship, and we look forward to the next 400 years of friendship between our communities. The city will celebrate this relationship during the upcoming Food at 400-plus festival in June, with participation from representatives of East Budleigh and the British Consulate General in Boston, including Scott Conant, celebrity chef and direct descendant of Roger Conant. Scott Conant will be honored with a city seal and will headline programming during the Food at 400-plus, with a featured appearance at Salem State University's Sophia Gordon Center for Creative and Performing Arts. Salem isn't just a city I'm visiting, it's where my family's American story began, said Scott Conant, taking part in this 400th anniversary in the place Roger Conant first established is deeply personal. I'm honored to share that connection through food, unquote. East Budleigh will honor Roger Conant and its first Peacemaker Festival, scheduled for May 15th through the 17th of 2026, commemorating the 400th anniversary of Conant's founding of Salem. The Bishop of Exeter will address the Peacemaker Festival, and there will be a celebration of village music, both of which will be recorded to share with Salem in June. There has been tremendous interest within the East Budleigh community in celebrating Roger Conant's achievements, said John Trister, chairman of the East Budleigh Parish Council. We're delighted to support this historic anniversary and to recognize the enduring connection between East Budleigh and Salem through our twinning. Dozens of local and middle school students are being honored in the state 2026 Scholastic Art and Writing Awards for their artistic and literary work. The annual awards celebrate artists, photographers, and writers in grades 7 through 12 across the nation. This year alone, more than 12,000 entries were submitted to the Massachusetts contest. Winners of a gold key and the highest award given in the competition will compete at a national level in March. The Gold Key Art Exhibition will be held March 14th through the 22nd at Tufts University's Breed Hall. The award ceremony for gold and silver key recipients will be held March 15th at Cohen Auditorium in the Ackerman Arts Center at Tufts. The schools that participated were Beverly High School, Bishop Fenwick, Danvers High School, Marblehead High School, Massaconut Regional High School, Salem High School, and St. John's Prep. And next, from the State House, price hikes for public workers are delayed. The Healey administration is walking back plans to increase group insurance rates for state workers after a backlash from public sector unions. The Group Insurance Commission, which manages health benefit plan for hundreds of thousands of state and municipal workers, tabled a scheduled vote Thursday on a proposal that called for increasing deductibles and copays while also eliminating coverage of GLP-1 medications used for weight management. Governor Maura Healey proposed the change in her preliminary $64 billion budget for the next fiscal year, arguing that state needs to reduce spending to offset projected revenue gaps. But the cost-cutting efforts sparked a backlash from public sector unions who say the changes could lead to higher out-of-pocket medical costs for hundreds of thousands of state and municipal employees. Union leaders held rallies in North Andover and ways to blunt the impact skyrocketing health care premiums that officials say are forcing people to make difficult budget decisions in order to afford medical treatment. Last month, Healey directed the State Division of Insurance to update and streamline prioritization with a wide range of medical procedures, including emergency and urgent care services, primary care, occupational physical therapy, and some prescription drugs. The Healey administration is also convening a 30-member health care affordability working group to come up with new recommendations to reduce health care costs and improve access to care. In July, the Healey administration directed state insurance regulators to pare back proposed health care plan price rates sought by commercial insurers this year, rejecting two proposals that call for double-digit increases. Insurers have pointed to hospital and prescription drug costs, specifically the booming demand for new weight loss and diabetes drugs, which they say are driving much of the rise in medical expenses for many employers. Other factors driving up medical spending include the use of inpatient and outpatient services, an aging population, and the increased cost of prescription weight loss medicines, the companies have said in their filings to regulators. And still from the State House, the House sets limits on AI in political ads. The State House of Representatives has approved a pair of bills setting new restrictions on the use of artificial intelligence in political campaigning. The proposals, which passed with bipartisan support, would require campaigns to disclose the use of AI in political advertisements and ban deceptive communications in campaign ads 90 days before an election. As artificial intelligence continues to reshape our economy and many aspects of our daily lives, lawmakers have responsibility to ensure that AI does not further the spread of misinformation in our politics, said House Speaker Ron Mariano. One bill prohibits anyone running for elected office from distributing deceptive or fraudulent synthetic ads within 90 days of an election in which the candidate or the political party will appear on state or local ballots. Violators would face fines of up to $1,000 under the proposal. Another bill would require political campaigns to disclose the use of any AI technology to generate TV, digital, or print ads targeting their opponents. With the rapid advancement in new media technologies, it's important that we have proper safeguards in place to ensure this technology is not abused or manipulated to intentionally mislead voters, said House Minority Leader Brad Jones, Republican from North Reading, a primary sponsor of the AI disclosure bill. Promoting the responsibility use of new technologies in campaign advertising will help to ensure that voters have access to reliable information so they can make an informed decision about whether to support a candidate, said Jones. Both of the measures must still pass the state Senate and survive Governor Maura Healey's veto pen to become law. Political observers are anticipating an onslaught of sophisticated AI-generated video and audio clips in presidential ads for television and social media sites ahead of the pivotal November midterm elections, which control of Congress will be up for grabs. A 2024 report issued by the Congressional Research Service, a public policy research arm of Congress, warned that deepfakes could also be generated by rogue countries or foreign adversaries to meddle in elections. But the widespread availability of the technology to manipulate video and photo means it's being used at virtually every level of political campaigning, from the presidency down to the local school board. The use of AI-generated deepfakes for the purpose of manipulating voters and disrupting elections is an attack on democracy, said State Representative Tricia Farley Bouvier, a primary sponsor of the 90-day cutoff bill. As technology advances, she said, at a rapid rate, voters should not have to wade through maliciously altered or AI-generated content to get the facts about an election. And next from Beverly, an intoxicated man fell from an exterior fire escape at the Cabot during a show at the theater Sunday night, Beverly police spokesman Mike Bacuzzi said. Police were called to the theater just after 8:30 p.m. when the man had fallen from a fire escape on the Judson Street side of the building. The man was taken to Beverly Hospital for non-life-threatening injuries, and there's no other update on that story. And that's all the local news in today's paper, so we'll move on to an op-ed piece from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch entitled, Will Trump Try to Sabotage the Midterms? Maya Angelou's often quoted advice, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time, is quoted so often because it's so obviously true. On January 6, 2021, President Donald Trump showed the world who he is, someone willing to undermine, interfere with, and ultimately attempt to overthrow any election result that does not go his way. And he's been showing us that again and again ever since. Trump's escalating power grabs will continue until a Congress is seated that will be willing to rein him in. This year's midterm voters can make that happen, but only if they start now organizing, mobilizing, and educating friends and fence-sitters about just how dangerous to democracy this president truly is. The latest demonstration of that danger has come in Trump's recent remarks about nationalizing America's elections. The Republicans should say, we want to take over, Trump said in a podcast released on Monday. We should take them over the voting in at least as many 15 places. The Republicans ought to nationalize the voting, unquote. It's unlikely Trump will or can follow through, like his 2022 call for termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution, in support of his phony election fraud claims. This one would run headlong into the plain language of that document, which puts the states in charge of the ballot. But there are other ways to take over elections, and Trump is testing them all. That's the whole point of his unprecedented campaign to get Missouri, Texas, and other red states to redraw their congressional districts when there's no new census to base it on. We know his goal with this re-gerrymandering campaign is to skew the midterms for the GOP because he says it publicly. The scheme may yet backfire. Missouri's re-gerrymandering stunt is facing a voter referendum that could well scuttle it. California's redrawn map, an understandable Democratic response to the map wars that Trump started, was just upheld by the Supreme Court. There is also Trump's militarization of blue cities, and only blue cities. While many Americans have taken to streets to protest, many more are undoubtedly cowering indoors, unnerved by the sight of mass agents with paramilitary weaponry and attire striking their streets. Anyone who suggests that only illegal immigrants have anything to be afraid of should ask the families of Renee Good and Alex Pretty. After what we've all seen these past months, can anyone seriously dismiss the likelihood that the whole point of this deeply un-American deployment is to intimidate blue state voters into staying home? Is that an alarmist suggestion? Tell it to Steve Bannon, the former White House advisor who still holds sway with Trump. He said on his podcast on Tuesday, "You're damn right we're going to have ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, surround the polls come November," he said. The administration is pursuing other schemes as well. Trump continues attacking the concept of mail-in voting, arguing, baselessly as always, that it's rife with fraud. The U.S. Supreme Court recently offered an assist in a Metro East case, ruling that candidates can challenge the validity of late-arriving mail-in ballots, even though sent on time and held up only because of slow mail service. Ponder that, and then ponder Trump's continuing project to gut the U.S. Postal Service of resources. Then there was the recent FBI raid on Fulton County, Georgia, 2020 election ballots, an expression of Trump's continuing inability to accept his 2020 loss. The raid was attended by National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard, for no reason that the administration has explained. Could it be that intimidating election officials is easier if the president's top spy is on the premises? History shows that the party in the White House generally loses ground in the midterms. Polling and early elections indicate that Patton will likely hold this year. History also predicts that if and when Republicans lose one or both chambers of Congress in November, our sitting president won't accept these results. Trump will do whatever he can, legal or otherwise, peaceful or otherwise, to overturn them. He'll falsely cry fraud with zero evidence, or he will concoct some phony national emergency to justify halting the peaceful transfer of power. Anyone had made such a prediction prior to January 6th could reasonably have been dismissed as an alarmist. But anyone today who dismisses this possibility is simply being naive. On that day, and in 5 years since, Donald Trump has repeatedly shown us exactly who he is. For the sake of our democracy, it's urgent that we believe him. And another op-ed piece from Their View, a dark day for sports journalism. Wednesday was one of the darkest days in the history of sports journalism. The renowned Washington Post sports section was shuttered, part of mass layoffs that included 30% of all of its employees, more than 300 of its roughly 800 journalists, according to the New York Times. The Post was founded in 1877 and is a national institution, earning acclaim for its coverage of Watergate and the Pentagon Papers. But sports fans in the greater Washington, D.C. area read the paper for its world-class writing penned by a series of superstar staffs, one which at one time included the murderer's row of John Feinstein, Tony Conesi, Michael Wiblin, Shirley Povich, and Thomas Boswell, under the direction of George Solomon, who was the paper's sports editor for 28 years. Povich was to D.C. what Suda Craig was to the Cumberland and the surrounding area, and I wouldn't be a sports reporter if not for the impact of Washington Post sports department. In 2011, Solomon founded the Shirley Povich Center for Sports Journalism at the University of Maryland, an institution that has educated and inspired countless young journalists like myself, a failed computer science major turned sports scribe. Its namesake was a columnist for 75 years at the Post and was the last living reporter to cover Babe Ruth until his death in 1998. At the high school level, the Washington's Post will... Washington sports editor Michael Ergo confirmed in a statement Wednesday that the all-met teams, which he called a time-honored tradition that will be reviewed as our foremost responsibility, would be lost as well. At the national level, it's impossible to imagine the Washington Post will not provide coverage of the Washington Commanders, Nationals, or Wizards. The Washington Post reported approximately $100 million in losses in 2024, but Wednesday's decision, which also included massive cuts to the Metro and Foreign Department, was hardly a necessary financial one. Jeff Bezos, the fourth richest man in the world, has seen his net worth increase by around $224 billion since purchasing the newspaper in 2013. According to the New York Times, Peter Baker, Bezos could absorb the company's annual losses for 5 years, what he makes in a single week. If you go on Twitter, you'll see comments from various threads saying good riddance to the Post dissolving its sports department. The belief comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of what journalism is. Readers in our increasingly illiterate society would rather consume news on social media, and in the sports sphere, they view breaking transactional information with Adam Schefter and Shams Charania at our field's finest examples of journalism. While the Post sports staff was reconciling with its impending job hunt following the destruction of what was a dream job, Charania broke the Washington Wizards' acquisition of 10-time All-Star Anthony Davis from the Mavericks in a blockbuster deal. There were no sports reporters at the Post to report the move, which still isn't detailed in an article on the paper's website. Charania would have scooped them anyway. But what's lost is the outlet's reporting of how the deal came to be and what it means to the future of the Wizards, which is what local Washington, D.C. readers care about. The Post's allure, like all truly exceptional newspapers, was in its thoughtful reporting, research, investigation, and storytelling. Without a Washington Post sports section, Dan Snyder would still own the Washington Commanders. The newspaper's reporting on Snyder in July of 2020 on the more than 40 female former employees who had been subjected to sexual harassment and workplace discrimination by Snyder and his cronies was directly responsible for a House investigation into the team in 2020. The report led to Snyder's eventual sale of the team to Josh Harris in 2023. It's a sign of the time. Sports have always been first on the chopping block at newspapers, drawing its just sports remarks at department meetings from editors of other sections at various times at all publications. For it to happen at the Washington Post, however, is something few could have predicted. It makes me sick to my stomach. At this rate, there will come a day when there is little or no print coverage of high school sports in the Cumberland area, no all-area teams or awards for locals to debate, no weekly statistical leaderboards, and no newspaper for radio stations, parents, and fan bases to complain about ad nauseum. It won't be today, tomorrow, or maybe even next year, but it will be sooner than any of us can imagine. It will be a dark day indeed, and the reporter who contributed that is Alex Rachwalski. He's a sports reporter at the Cumberland Times News. Olympians and Bad Bunny remind us to set aside differences to advocate for a better America. This from the Bangor Daily News in Maine. Two sporting events remind us that we must not let fear of people who are different from us divide us and, worse, lead to hatred and anger. For months, the Trump administration and its supporters maligned singer Bad Bunny, who was chosen to perform the halftime show during this year's Super Bowl. Sunday's performance by the singer, whose name is Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio, showcased the foolishness and bigotry behind the anger directed at him. Bad Bunny recently collected Grammy Awards and is the top-selling artist in the world. His performance was the second most-watched Super Bowl halftime show ever. We didn't understand the words sung in Spanish during the 13-minute performance, but the message was clear. It was about family, community, pride, and love. He also reminded us that America is not just the United States, but the many countries in North, South, and Central America, and that together we are greater. The response from conservative, often white, critics was pathetic. Some wanted Bad Bunny deported. He's Puerto Rican, and therefore an American citizen. Others complained about lyrics that they didn't sing on Sunday. Yes, some of the songs contain profanity, but that's far less of a problem than singing about child rape, as does Kid Rock, the featured performer in the barely-watched alternative halftime show put on by Turning Point USA. Much of Bad Bunny's message sailed over the heads of his critics. Far-right activist Laura Luma, for example, idiotically criticized him for not pointing out the poor conditions of Puerto Rico's power grid. That's precisely what he did by singing and dancing atop a sparking power lines. If a performance that featured a real wedding, family values anyone, homages to family and the central role of elders, and messages of love, cultural pride, and interconnectedness was so threatening, maybe your worldview is the problem. The Winter Olympics kicked off in Milan, Italy, days before the Super Bowl. Already, American athletes have collected medals and sparked controversy with mid-criticism of the current state of affairs in America. American athletes who have dared to voice even a hint of criticism of Trump's administration policies, particularly ICE's roundups of immigrants, most of whom do not have criminal records, have been insulted and threatened by conservatives and the president. There is no political litmus test to be an American Olympian. There is no requirement to praise the president or his administration. Those are hallmarks of authoritarian nations, not democracy like the United States. And let's not forget that plenty of the athletes representing America in Italy are part of our country's immigrant success story. According to research by the Institute for Immigration Research at George Mason University, more than 13% of the American athletes at the Winter Olympics have immigrant parents. Most notably, celebrated figure skater and gold medal favorite Ilya Manlinin, a student at GMU, is the son of immigrants from Uzbekistan. Two-time gold medal-winning snowboarder Chloe Kim, who was chasing a third in Italy, is the daughter of immigrants from South Korea. That doesn't make them any less Americans than someone who traces their American ancestry back to generations, or someone whose parents came from Africa or South America or Puerto Rico. Consistent with the ideals of the Olympics, excellence, respect, and friendship, the U.S. has for many generations and in many ways met immigrants and refugees with a welcoming spirit, Marissa Chris, the assistant director of the Institute of Immigration Research, and Jim White, professor emeritus of sociology at George Mason and the founding director of the Institute, wrote in a recent op-ed column. This spirit, they said, has been instrumental in providing a sanctuary and opportunities for millions of displaced individuals. In return, most immigrants and refugees work hard, contribute, and give back to their new communities. Some become naturalized citizens. A select, dedicated few even represent their new nation on a global stage, such as the Olympics. We'll be watching and cheering them on, regardless of their place of birth. We couldn't agree more. As we cheer on the world's best athletes, it's time to put away our divisions and fear based on where someone is born and the color of their skin or who they love. We are all Team America. Well, in today's reading with a little bit of history trivia, on this day in 1801, the U.S. House of Representatives broke an electoral tie between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, electing Jefferson president and Burr became vice president. In 1863, five appointees of the Public Welfare Society of Geneva announced the formation of an international community for the relief of wounded combatants, which would later be renamed the International Committee of the Red Cross. In 1864, during the Civil War, the Union ship USS Housatonic was rammed and sunk in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, by the Confederate hand-crank submarine H.L. Hunley in the first naval attack of its kind. The Hunley also sank. And in 1897, the forerunner of the National PTA, the National Congress of Mothers, convened its first meeting in Washington with over 2,000 attendees. And in 1992, serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer was sentenced to life imprisonment after being found guilty of 15 counts of first-degree murder. And in 2008, Kosovo declared its independence from Serbia. And that's a wrap for the Salem News. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you all have a great day.